Officials in New York say the wind may be responsible for disabling two commuter trains this morning. Several thousand feet of overhead wires became tangled and then torn apart. About 150 passengers were stranded for nearly 3 hours. The weather also disrupted some New Year celebrations. Baltimore postponed its fireworks display until tonight because of high winds and rough water in the harbor. Other celebrations were toned down or even canceled because of the economy. The mayor of Reno, Nevada, said with so many people losing their jobs in that city, it didn't seem right to spend $20 or $1,000 on something that just goes up in smoke. I'm Noor Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org.
WILL programs are made possible with support from the Art Mart in Lincoln Square, Urbana. The Art Mart offers unique items for the home and kitchen and a deli and bakery featuring Reuben's chocolates. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio. Support for today's broadcast comes from Prospect Bank, coming soon at the corner of Prospect and Kirby in Champaign. Dick O'Neill and the team at Prospect Bank are committed to providing Champaign-Urbana with a fresh perspective on banking. Information at theprospectbank.com. Member FDIC. Prospect Bank is a division of Edgar County Bank and Trust.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. On the morning of August 13th of 1961, the people of East Berlin woke to find themselves cut off from family, friends, and jobs. What started out as a barbed wire fence soon became a wall that would stand for almost 30 years as a potent symbol of the Cold War. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll talk about what that wall meant for the German people and also for the world. And our guest is Frederick Taylor. He is the author of a new book that looks at the history of the wall, and the title of the book is The Berlin Wall, A World Divided, 1961 to 1989. HarperCollins is the publisher of the book. It has just come out recently, and certainly you can find it in the bookstore. Our guest, Frederick Taylor, studied history and modern languages at Oxford University and Sussex University. A Volkswagen Studentship Award enabled him to research and travel widely in both parts of the divided Germany at the height of the Cold War. He's also authored another book entitled Dresden, which is a history of the city and what happened there during World War II. He makes his home in England, in Cornwall, and he's speaking to us from there today by telephone. Mr. Taylor, hello.
Hello there.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, you're welcome. It's good to be on your program.
The place to start, I think, is, as you do, is just to remind people of the conditions just after the war in Germany, and the fact that the country was divided. It was divided into four zones, each one controlled by one of the Allied powers, Britain, France, the United States, the Soviet Union. And then the city of Berlin itself also was divided into four sectors, controlled by the U.S., Britain, France, and the Soviets. And perhaps the major complicating factor here is the fact that the city of Berlin was in the Soviet zone. And once we get to the point where the other three zones, where the British, French, and American zones eventually become what we called West Germany, and the Soviet zone became East Germany, then, for all parties concerned, Berlin became a serious problem because it was in the sphere of Soviet influence.
That's absolutely right. And it was, in fact, of course, they had already, in the early 50s, put up a big fence on the border between East and West Germany. But for various political and military reasons, that had not happened in Berlin. So although there were patrols and there were checkpoints there, people could travel pretty freely back and forth between East and West Berlin, which meant that East Germans, who got fed up with living in East Germany, which, given the standard of living and the lack of political freedom, was quite a few of them, could, if they could get into East Berlin, get into West Berlin, from whence they could be flown to West Germany and resettled in the West. 2.5 million did this between 1948 and 1961. which led to our crisis. It led to the East Germans' problem and the crisis we're talking about today.
Mm-hmm. And certainly one has to appreciate the fact that for the East Germans, this was indeed a serious problem. Many people left, as you say. A lot of these were young people, and they were people who were well-educated.
Absolutely.
And had skills. And for these were people that the GDR could not afford to lose. And finally, apparently, it got to the point where the government said, we've got to do something about this.
Yes, it was either that or, you know, who's going to be the last one to turn out the lights, you know, the way things were going. And they had been trying to persuade the Soviets, and this is the point. The Soviets, although they were prepared for drastic measures, as we know historically, were kind of reluctant at first. But it's really only in the last few months, when the situation in East Germany reached a kind of crisis level, what the Germans call Torschluss panic, panic at the closing of the door, that the Russians were finally persuaded by the East German authorities, particularly the East German dictator, Walter Ulbricht, that something had to be done, that something had to be a wall between the two parts of the city. It was a very drastic solution. It's kind of unimaginable.
A part of the book is, a goodly section of the book, really does deal with the period leading up to the creation of what ended up being West and East Germany. Certainly one could probably write an entire book just about that. And so I don't want to spend too much time there. I'm sure books indeed have been written. Can you just in a sense give a sketch of what happened here, and would we have to say that somehow, given the fact that what became East Germany started out as being the Soviet zone, and that the Soviets were interested in having that be part of the Soviet sphere, and there certainly were German communists who were interested in being involved in that as well, was this kind of division and the ultimate creation of the two Germanies, do you think that was something that was somehow inevitable?
I think it was quite inevitable. I mean, there are some scholars who argue that it wasn't, indeed, that the Americans in particular were as much responsible as the Russians for what happened. But it became extremely likely the moment relations between the wartime allies broke down. Stalin was not known for giving up territory that he had once taken, and the part of Germany that had cost at least 30 million Russian lives to conquer between 1941 and 1945 was not something he was about to give up unless he got a big, big prize for giving it up, and that I don't think he was going to get. He wanted perhaps a neutral Germany with all forces removed and with the communists in a strong position there, and who knows, perhaps able to dominate that too. Looking at what happened in Czechoslovakia, where you had a similar situation, and there was a communist coup in 1948. I think by that time, most people, including the West Germans and the Western Allies, had decided that the Russians could not be trusted. I think that was the crucial point where it became inevitable that the two Germanies would go into some either formal or informal division, and it became formalized in 1948-1949. You had the Federal Republic in the West, about 55 million people, increasingly prosperous, and East Germany, the GDR, the German Democratic Republic in the East, which people weren't starving, but the standard of living was much lower, and they had undergone much more deprivation after the war at the hands of the Russians, with their taking of reparations from factories and tearing up railway lines. They tore up a third of the railway network and shipped it off to Russia. And, of course, there was terrible violence, rape of German women and so on, that occurred in the Russian zone, particularly in the early days after victory. So you had this situation where, really, I think, although it might not have been formalized in quite the way it was, I think by 48, certainly, some kind of division had become essential. I mean, they had become, already by that time, distinct social and political systems. In other words, you couldn't, you know, capitalism was basically being abolished in the Eastern Zone. The parties, although technically allowed to exist, political parties, were in fact controlled by the communists, the German communists, and indeed the Soviet authorities, while in the West you had a flawed but nevertheless developing and lately flourishing democracy of the kind that we would recognize.
Mm. Our guest, just quickly to introduce again, is Frederick Taylor. He is the author of a new book that looks at the history of the Berlin Wall. That is the title, The Berlin Wall, A World Divided. It's just recently published by HarperCollins. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. As you said, the man who here in the East German government was really the driving force here behind the creation of the wall was Walter Ulbricht. Tell us something about him.
He was a saddler from Leipzig in Saxony. Most Germans think the Saxons talk funny, and he's frequently imitated in his lifetime and even since. So well known did his voice become. He was a doer type, very, very hardworking, very ruthless, and I think in his way an idealistic communist. He survived the Hitler period in exile in Russia. And that wasn't easy. A lot of German communists ended up in the gulag or with a bullet in the back of the neck. Ulbricht didn't. He was a consummate schemer. And so he was sent basically back to Germany at the end of April 1945, when Berlin was in flames and just before Hitler killed himself, to mastermind the small but kind of obviously very potent communist group that would try and take control of Berlin, with the aid, of course, of the occupying Russians. There were no, at that time, for several months, no Western troops in Berlin, only Russians. So he was an organization man. He was a communist organization man. He'd been party secretary for Greater Berlin and a member of the Politburo before Hitler came to power. He was used to power and he knew how to use it.
And it seems remarkable that he went back to, after having been out of Germany for a long time, for a number of years, went back into Berlin right after the end of the war, when certainly the place was in complete chaos. Conditions were very bad, and he seemed right from the beginning determined to build a government, build a communist government. And I'm sure that other people would have looked at him and said, how do you think we're going to do this? He thought, well, you know, of course we're going to do this. There was no problem for this doing this. And everybody else looked at him and looked around them and said, how are we going to do this?
And he did it. He was unflappable in that peculiar way that his kind of totalitarian bureaucrat is. He knew he had the support of the Russian army, who controlled everything. And he simply said, look, guys, this is a quote from somebody who was on the party who later defected to the West. He said, it must look democratic, but we must have everything in our hands. And that's exactly what they did. What they would do, they would find a mayor for some kind of nice middle-class part of Berlin, guy who wore a tie. They'd pick them off the street sometimes. And he would look respectable and middle class and wasn't a communist, but his deputy would be a communist. It was what they called the regime of deputies. And there would always be a communist in charge of the police. And so basically, it looked as though the guys in the suits and the ties were in charge and that they were not communists. They shouldn't be Nazis either, but they weren't communists. And they would go on from there, just working the leaves of power through basically what were puppet mayors and district councillors. He was unflappable, and of course, you know, they weren't starving. They were holed up in a hotel, you know, being served food from the Russian PX or Russian equivalent of the PX, and they worked on from there. They didn't do a bad job, actually. I mean, in terms of absolute emergency supplies for the city, which they persuaded the Russians to come up with, and in terms of actually getting a basic administration for the city running within 3 or 4 weeks. They were ruthless. They were not nice men, but they were good at what they did.
Mm. As we talked a little bit before here, the problem for the government of East Germany was the fact that here in the middle of East Germany we had the city of Berlin, which was also similarly divided between East and West. And for them, it was a problem because for some of their best and brightest, most able, skilled, educated people, this was a way out. It was a hole, essentially, that they could literally and metaphorically that they could get through. And that so the East German government government decided, well, we've got to do something about this. We've got to literally build a wall. When Ulbricht proposed this to the rest of the government of East Germany, what was the reaction?
They didn't argue with him. He had trouble from the Russians, but I think everybody had pretty much agreed in the East German leadership that something very, very drastic had to happen. I mean, it wasn't that easy to get from East to West Berlin, actually. One of the misapprehensions people have is that kind of, you know, there was a totally free movement between East and West Berlin before the war went up. In fact, nobody who was sneaking off to the West and hoping to kind of emigrate would take, say, a suitcase. Mm. You know, you get picked up off a train or somebody say, where are you going with that suitcase? What is your plan? I mean, it was actually illegal to leave East Germany without a permit, but of course it was very hard to enforce that law. So they had gotten used to the idea that they would restrict movement. And it was just a matter for them of, can we do it? I mean, physically, can we organize it? And they decided that they could, and they persuaded the Russians that they could, and they did. The Russians themselves were kind of reluctant because they knew it would both, shall we say, cause a kind of possible problem with the West. They didn't expect war, but they expected problems, and they expected also that it would actually spoil their own access rights to West Berlin and West Germany, which they still held under the post-war military settlement. So kind of the Russians had their doubts, but really when they saw that it was either that or lose their satellite, East Germany, which was a very valuable pawn to them and something, as I said, the Russians had paid blood for to gain control of, they finally caved in. Oddly enough, Kennedy, according to oral history evidence in the Kennedy Library, Kennedy himself had said to Walt Rostow just a few days beforehand, had said, the East Germans can't carry on doing this, and the Russians can't let this happen. What do you think about a wall? And so that's the first mention of it. But this is just casually dropped by Kennedy during a conversation for Rostow, I think, in July 1961. So everybody had an idea that something drastic had to happen. And once they had decided that they had enough barbed wire, enough bricks, and enough cops and troops to carry it out, they did it. And they had the element of surprise simply because no matter how theoretically you know something like that can happen, you don't really think it will. Not in a city. Imagine, you know, a wall through Chicago or New York or London. It's impossible to imagine. No matter how somebody tells you it's possible, it's actually impossible to conceive of.
Yeah. The big one, I think one of the very big central questions here, very interesting questions as well, that you write about, and it is something that perhaps goes counter to what people would think, goes to this question of why it is that the West, Britain, France, the United States, did not more aggressively take some action and try to fight the construction of the wall. Why is it that we allowed them to do it, even though that it was something that we publicly decried?
Well, that's there's a short answer, a long answer to that. I'll give you the middling answer.
Okay.
Robert Lochner, who was the U.S. Information Bureau's guy in Berlin who controlled also RIAS, which was the radio in the American sector, and was there at the time when the wall was built, said, you know, that really the only way he could have seen that happening would be if in the hours after the East Germans started putting down their original fence, it was a wire fence initially before they started building the wall, if the Allies had been able to say, what are you doing, and go and roll straight into it in those initial hours in the middle of the night, between Saturday and Sunday, 12th, 13th of August, and at the same time send a message to the Russians saying, you obviously are not aware of what your East German allies are doing, but we're going to have to stop them on your behalf, or some such fabrication, then they might have got away with it. But it wasn't really possible. You couldn't do something like that without consulting Washington and London and Paris and the West Germans, for that matter, as well, and he knew it. Now, as far as the U.S. was concerned, they simply did, I think, it was less hypocritical. It was a cold calculation on Kennedy and his administration's part. And frankly, I don't think it would have been that much different under Eisenhower, or if Nixon had beaten Kennedy and had been president at the time, that really, unless the East Germans and the Russians threatened West Berlin, that is the Western held sectors, there wasn't really much worth doing, you know. And the British and the French thought that too. But apart from that, I think, and here's the trick, here's the true hypocrisy of the whole thing and the thread that runs through it, neither the British nor the French were terribly interested in a reunified Germany. They were, in fact, secretly, it's possible to see this from the kind of memos and letters and correspondence in the archives, that they were actually quite pleased by the idea that the division of Germany was being set in stone, set in brick, in effect, through the wall. It left a prosperous West Germany, which was part of NATO, but relatively weak compared with the Germany they'd spent the last almost 100 years having trouble with in three wars if you're French, two wars if you're British. And so that was basically what was going on, was everybody was saying, oh, isn't this terrible, you know, our poor German friends being oppressed like this. But while the Americans simply looked at the cold calculation and said, if we do something about this, we may be starting another war and it just isn't worth it. And the British and the French thought the same thing and then said, actually, we're quite pleased with this. Hmm. This brings stability and it brings us a weak Germany, which is just what we like.
So that's it. In a sense, in a realpolitik sense, that we're talking about here is it was the border between the two Germanies and in a sense also the problem of Berlin was a potential conflict point, and that as long as it was leaky, that made things very difficult.
For
everybody. But in a sense, the wall, rather than becoming a problem, it actually solved a problem, and that everyone...
Look at the other two divided countries in the Cold War, Vietnam and Korea, and ask yourself. The third one was Germany, where you had a nation divided by the Cold War. And if you look at the experience of Korea and Vietnam, you're not looking at anything that is terribly... gives you a lot of optimism about what happens to divided countries unless that division is pretty well sealed and sorted out. So in a way, it was a relatively bloodless solution to a difficult problem. I mean, it's very interesting looking at White House messages to Berlin Operations Center in the first half of 1961, which is the CIA HQ, and looking at, you know, George Bundy saying, can we cause trouble in East Germany? Would this deter the East Germans from causing trouble in West Berlin and so on? And the old CIA hands, who were not softies, saying, well, not really, it's not a good idea, because the results are incalculable. What happens if we do roll into East Germany, roll the wall back? It might have been an uprising in East Berlin on behalf of the West. What happens then? What happens if the Russians march into East Berlin and start to put the rebellion down? Do our troops go in and help the rebels? You know, you had all these kind of things coming up. If you look at the way the game of chess is played, these are the calculations that everybody is making. I mean, if you look at the Hungarian Revolution in 1956, they claim that they've been encouraged to rise up against the Russians by Western radio stations, and there's some truth in that. But when the rebellion was crushed by the Russians, the Brits and the Americans and the French and all the rest of them did absolutely nothing about it. And the situation in Germany, if that happened, would be even worse, because you have a divided country where there's a very, very fluid situation. Mm. So it's kind of, you know, it's brutal, but interesting. It is brutal realpolitik. You know, and no matter how sympathetic you feel to people suffering, you look at a situation on a global scale, which, of course, particularly in the case of America, which was already, of course, the larger of the two superpowers with global commitments. They had Laos. They had even the trouble in the Congo. They had Korea simmering away. They had the Taiwan situation simmering away. They had Cuba. The last thing they wanted was to get tied up in another mess in the middle of Europe.
We are at a midpoint here again. Our guest, Frederick Taylor. He's the author of a new book that looks at the history of the Berlin Wall. It is The Berlin Wall, A World Divided. It is published by HarperCollins, just out. He's joining us by telephone from where he lives in England. And questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. And we do have someone here to bring in Urbana, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I was curious as to, I noticed the BBC had a piece about the recent Stasi records that were shredded and then sort of reassembled by a computer program, and I'm probably too new for you to have read them, but one of the things I've always been interested about in all these sort of environments is how the let's say, the East Germans, which seem to be more rabid communists than the Russians, sort of similar to North Korea, is, you know, Stalinist, I guess, but when Russia's, you know, and after Stalin died. And I'm wondering if you comment on things like that. I know you were you and David were talking earlier about the reasons why the West probably didn't get involved, and I think I agree with you that the English and the French didn't want a reunited Germany anyway. And even at the end, in when the whole thing collapsed and Germany reunited, I remember reading extensively about it in the French press, especially about this sort of like this nervousness about them getting back together again.
It's like somehow completely panicked.
Yeah, well, you're right. It was almost like, I mean, in the United States, I read it was, oh, communism's dead, and the French and the English were like, oh, Christ, the Germans are back together again, and what's going to happen? Now, I ask you a question. I know, have you been to East Germany lately? Because I'm wondering if you see about the United Germany, but you also hear, if you read the German press, about how East Germany is still sort of a laggard. They almost seem to be like, you know, the poor cousins from the East. And I'm wondering if you could comment on that. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, as far as the rabidness of German communists goes, they did actually invent communism. Let's not forget that. Marx and Engels. Yeah, recently, yes, I've been to East Germany a lot. I mean, I have researching my book on Dresden. I spent a lot of time there, which used to be in East Germany. And I go to Berlin a lot and go into East Berlin a lot. And I discuss a lot with friends I've made over there and meet people and drive around and so on. East Germany is in a strange position. It was basically stripped by the Russians largely. And a lot, Saxony and Thuringia, which are about half of East Germany, were actually the cradles of the German Industrial Revolution, the Manufacturing Revolution, certainly. And before the war, before the Second World War, they were actually the most prosperous parts of Germany at all. I mean, compared with the Rhineland and Bavaria, which are now West Germany, they were quite considerably richer. But after the war, when a lot of businesses were expropriated, and obviously the climate became very unfavorable for any kind of private enterprise business activity, patents, capital, and expertise emigrated to West Germany from what had been well-established companies, many of them household names, like Zeiss and so on, emigrated to West Germany and set up in the kind of what had been previously been not really industrial cities. And prospered mightily throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and 80s. So when the wall came down, East Germany, the situation reversed itself. So East Germany became poorer than the West, whereas previously it had been the other way around. And there have been some revivals. Dresden's doing not too bad. Leipzig's doing not too bad. Jena, Zwickau, a few other places. The so-called lighthouse industrial areas, a lot of light industry, high tech, and so on. The problem really is in the provincial towns and the villages, where there's been a terrific emigration of skilled and educated labor, rather like the situation before 1961, leaving a bunch of young men with nothing much to do. The girls have gone. The young women have left East Germany, particularly provincial East Germany, at a terrific rate over the last 10 years. Unemployment is relatively high. That's where the whole problem with the far right comes from. Too much drinking, too much hanging out with the guys, too much reading those books that Granddad has left over from the war. And oddly enough, I saw an article recently which said that the correlation for the spread of of neo-Nazism in East Germany seems to be working out so that it's not so much the raw unemployment rate, but the fact of whether there are young women around. In other words, if a lot of young women have left the town or village, leaving a majority of young men with no chance of getting a partner, then you are more likely to have have neo-Nazis gaining recruits in the air. Of course, the whole everything's connected. But it's a difficult situation. The country itself is not in that bad a shape to look at. The problem is that you have these young men with nothing to do and not much hope of getting good jobs or or getting partners. And it leads to a kind of depressive violence which is localized. I mean, if you look at the votes for neo-Nazis in the elections in East Germany, they're not all that high, about 10%. That sounds like a lot, but you've got to compare that with depressed areas of other parts of Western Europe, and you'll find that it's not that different. The real problem is that you'll get these kind of no-go areas, these little areas where foreigners, people of kind of liberal or democratic conviction are liable to be persecuted, have violence committed against them, and so on. And so that's a very nasty situation. But it's not actually threatening to the fabric of the state itself, i.e. that of United Germany. It's kind of bleak out there, but I don't think it's hopeless. I think if things continue as they seem to be in East Germany, there will be a gradual development of industries and also development of a kind of a tax base from which the country can go forward.
Well, again, I want to thank the caller. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's go again to someone here where we are, Champaign County, line 2. Hello.
Hi. Given you've said that, you know, it served the particularly America's interests to have the division, what kind of evidence is there of sort of a tacit collusion, if I could call it that, in making it happen, in the sense, not necessarily expecting a wall to be, but just the whole Berlin airlift. I mean, the way that Berlin was handled, making it a showpiece, subsidizing, allowing people to to go there to, you know, you could get out of your military service by just living in Berlin, which certainly kind of
felt.
I mean, I just. But the major point is that, you know, what kind of. Obviously, this is very, very subject to rumination and conspiracy allegations, et cetera.
Well, exactly.
What do you think?
Hints and allegations, as they say, yeah.
Well, yeah,
well,
go ahead.
Henry Jackson, Senator Jackson, certainly, and I think at the end of July. Kennedy made a pretty tough speech and so on, although he went far short of giving any kind of guarantees against the division of Berlin, as long as it didn't affect Western interests there. But Henry Jackson, the senator, Scoop, I think was his nickname, wasn't it? Made a speech a few days before the war went up, in which he pretty much said, "Why haven't these guys done something? You know, I don't think the U.S. would do anything about it." I'm paraphrasing. I mean, it's a while since I read the documents. But it attracted a lot of attention at the time. In May, although I can't prove it either because we don't have the documents from the Russian side, have helped Khrushchev and his advisors to think, well, you know, the West are not, as long as we don't go too far, the West is not going to do anything about this. Who knows? A collusion, I don't know. I think people wanted something to be settled. They wanted that. They were fed up with that part of Europe, that part of the world being constantly problematic. There were so many other problems going on in other parts of the world threatening Western and American interests that, I don't know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, perhaps. But you know, that doesn't take any of the blame from the Russians and the East Germans for committing what was obviously, in many ways, a barbaric act. But, you know, that's big politics, I'm afraid.
Scoop was a very influential, as you say, Cold Warrior. So,
absolutely.
He gave a public speech something has to be done with all these people crossing, or something to that effect.
Well, yeah, that he would understand if something happened.
Huh. Later on, a couple of years ago, in the West, people said, let's put it back up and build it 2 foot higher, if I recall. one of the attitudes that people have.
Well, you know.
I mean, this is obviously a console of despair.
Stuff,
and
East Germans say stuff, too. There's a whole thing that somebody set up an old East German-style hotel for nostalgia, for those who have nostalgia for the old days. You know, and everybody says, well, the East Germans want the wall back and the West Germans want the wall back. It's one of those things, isn't it? It's kind of guys in a bar talking about stuff. And I don't think they really do. I think the West is fed up with paying for the East. I don't think they quite realize the historic economic debt that they owe to the East. But there you are. I'm quite sympathetic with the East's complaints, actually, in that regard. I don't think that's
true. What historic debt are you referring to there? Actually, I don't know.
The whole transfer of wealth that went from East to West Germany in the 50s and 60s during the communist period, and that the East has never got back. I think, you know, the East has a right to be aggrieved. I mean, nobody likes paying money for people who appear not to be helping themselves. And that is the attitude the West Germans have towards the East Germans. I think there's a generation of East Germans growing up now, the younger, more educated types, who can integrate into the capitalist economy. I think a lot of East Germans did have a lot of trouble figuring out how to survive in a capitalist economy. There was that old joke, wasn't there, in the Eastern Bloc, you know, we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us. And that was pretty much how East Germany was run. It's a very tricky problem, but I don't think any Germans really, in their heart of hearts, stone cold sober and having a serious conversation, except for a few jokers, would really want the wall back.
I want to thank the caller. We have about 10 minutes left, and we certainly would like to invite the others, if there are folks that'd like to call in with questions. I'd like to also to introduce again our guest, Frederick Taylor. He's a British writer and translator. He's the author of a book, Dresden, which is about the city and its experience in World War II. He studied history and modern languages at Oxford and Sussex University, has traveled quite a lot in both parts of the divided Germany at the height of the Cold War, and is author of a new book, The Berlin Wall, A World Divided, 1961 to 1989. It's a history of the wall, published by HarperCollins. The United States, certainly when the wall went up, certainly the United States did say and demonstrate that it would defend the people of West Germany and also the people of West Berlin.
Yeah, that was where the line was drawn, yeah.
And that, although, is it clear exactly what that would have meant, and was the United States willing to go to war with the Soviet Union over this?
Well, you can never entirely know, can you? But that's how the plans were drawn up, basically. If there were another blockade, you know, West Berlin had been blockaded for almost a year in 1948-49 under Stalin and had survived via an airlift. If that happened again, but more to the point, if, say, the Russians and the East Germans marched into West Berlin, and there were only about 12,000 Western troops there, in terms of kind of the 400,000 Soviet troops and something between, I think, 40,000 and 80,000 East German troops that were surrounding Berlin. There wasn't much they could have done about it. Then I think there might have been a war, yeah. I mean, I think this was a point at which you would have to say, we're not going to put up with this. If you look at the Checkpoint Charlie confrontation, which happened a couple of months after the wall went up, that was not about the wall, existence of the wall itself. It was about a threat, essentially, to American prestige. They were demanding documents from American personnel, which had not been demanded from them since the war, in order to go into East Berlin. They're supposed to have free access under the post-war agreements between the victorious powers. That was when you had Russian and American tanks facing each other at Checkpoint Charlie with their motors running and their guns pointing at each other. It was a matter of prestige, and I think any kind of invasion would have been similar. I actually did interview Robert McNamara for the book, and he said, although Cuba was terrifying, in a way, Berlin, because you didn't quite know what was going to happen in detail. You had the situation in Cuba, you had the missile bases you either bombed or you didn't, and then you had the ships bringing the missiles in where you're going to stop them and where you're going to search them, where you're going to confiscate the missiles and what would happen then. So that was that crisis. In the case of Berlin, you had autobahns full of troops going up and down and so on. If there was some kind of incident, for instance, between East Germans and American troops or British troops, or Russians and British troops and American troops, perhaps even an accidental shootout, if things escalated from there, you would pretty soon get to a position where, unless you use nuclear weapons, you were not going to be able to defend what you held. So it could have escalated very quickly if we'd been unlucky.
Hmm. Well, let's take another caller here, someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, I can't say I had the good fortune. I had the opportunity, while a member of the United States Army and stationed in Germany, to visit West Berlin and also East Berlin through Checkpoint Charlie back in 1974, and I did see the starkness of the Berlin Wall. And also, I thought the difference in quality of life on West Berlin side as opposed to the East Berlin side. But maybe I was just looking at it through the lenses of a United States Army soldier. But my question to you, I want to move forward to what some would say was pure theater, and of course some who believe Ronald Reagan walked on water, that he really made a difference when he said when the wall was there back in whenever he went to East or West Berlin and said, Mr. Gorbachev, bring down this wall or tear down this wall. What effect, if any, did Ronald Reagan have with that pronouncement in bringing down the Berlin Wall?
It's difficult because I think 10 years earlier, an American president going to Berlin and saying, Mr. Brezhnev, tear down this wall, would have had no consequence at all, apart from hollow laughter from the Russian side. I think Russia was weakened and self-conscious and aware of its problems by the mid-80s in such a way that Reagan's kind of aggressive, pushy tone did hit home. But in the book, I think Reagan did influence, although he influenced them via Afghanistan rather than marching up to the wall and telling Gorbachev to tear it down. But I think the Helsinki agreements, which the Eastern Bloc, including East Germany, entered into, which were supposedly going to allow all kinds of civil rights to their own citizens, did have a gradual effect in undermining self-confidence in the Eastern Bloc and in undermining their ability to confess about how they were actually treating their own citizens. In other words, they had been weakened both militarily economically and also politically by the Helsinki agreements. I mean, I know everybody thinks communists are cynical, and they are, but they do claim to be democracies. So even if they sign a piece of paper which they have very little intention of taking seriously, they have to then justify it in a way that Nazis, for instance, don't. Nazis never pretend to be Democrats. Nazis are kind of totalitarian, authoritarian, and everybody does as they're told. Communists pretend to be Democrats, German Democratic Republic,
right,
and so on. And that made it very tricky for them. I think there was a whole coming together in the mid-80s that made the collapse of East Germany more and more likely. A lot of it was economic. It was going on in the background. The price of oil, all this stuff was going on. They were running out of money. They were running out of raw materials. And the Russians were less and less prepared to bail them out. And that's what really caused the end of East Germany, rather than Ronald Reagan, magnificent showman as he was, marching up to the wall and trying to stir their consciences.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks. So in a sense, I asked earlier about whether the wall going up was somehow inevitable. Was the coming down of the wall, was that in a sense inevitable? Was it just a set of circumstances where things just completely got away from the government of East Germany and in a sense they came to the point where they couldn't have stopped it even if they would have wanted to?
If the East German economy, when in fact the whole Soviet bloc was in serious economic trouble by the 80s, if the East German economy had been able to supply the people with enough of the good things of life to keep them happy, then you have, even then, a paradox, because if that's necessary, if you can supply your people with the good things of life to keep them happy, eventually you won't need the wall. And if you can't, then your state actually is struggling, and it will not, in the long term, survive. And so you're going to lose the wall in another way. So I suppose you could say, in a way, it was inevitable. Not that the East German leadership thought so. I mean, they were already made plans for a high-tech wall. This was the computer age by the late 80s, in which everything would be electronically controlled. I mean, a huge surveillance system of the most modern type was planned to be put into place during the early 90s. Hmm. Never happened. The wall was no longer there. But the old men in charge, and most of them were old by this point in East Berlin, were still making these plans. I think they had lost pretty much most of the essential contact with reality by this point.
Let's see if we get one or two more callers here in the time that's left. Line two is next in Champaign.
Yes, is that me?
Yes.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I want to say, first of all, thank you so very much for having a program about Berlin. It is my favorite place on the planet. I've had the privilege of living there for a number of years in the 80s, and am a German teacher here in town, and always so happy to introduce my students to this fabulous city. They all want to go to the Love Parade. Okay, yeah. So that's kind of, and yeah. I think it's, I know early on when the wall came down, it was said that one place where the East and West met was in the culture of techno music, that young people would, all.
Yeah, my kids have all been there, too.
Beg pardon?
My kids have all been to Berlin now, too. They'll have a great time.
Specifically for the Love Parade?
Well, the whole thing, the whole scene. Particularly in East Berlin now, of course. That's the funky part of Berlin. West Berlin is now kind of quite boring and middle class.
Right, right.
Everything exciting is happening in what used to be the East.
Uh-huh. I've also heard that since the World Cup final was there last year, and just the World Cup in general, that this summer Berlin has experienced a huge tourist boom. Do you know anything about that? That because everybody said, what a cool place. I really want to come back here.
It's also cheap.
Yeah, right, right. Well, still, yeah.
It's half the price of London. I mean, London is probably now one of the most expensive cities in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Brits know to our cost.
Mm-hmm.
But, Berlin is cheap, it's cheerful, it's good fun.
Uh-huh.
And I hope Berlin is coming back, I think.
Uh-huh.
It has to. They're an indomitable breed, the Berliners.
Absolutely. I want to add, too, because I thought the last caller made a comment I hear all the time. Many Americans think that it was Ronald Reagan who brought down the wall. And I was very interested to hear your response. I certainly remember, I think, Phil Collins' band played in Berlin, I think, in 87. And that was when I was living there. And that was a big wake-up for me personally, because there was so much demonstrating going on the other side of the wall. And, again, I think the youth culture, that a lot was happening there. I want to ask a fast question, and then I'll hang up and listen for your answer. I hate to malign any Berliners. I really like them. It seems that, and also because you know Dresden so well, I know that like in Leipzig they were having demonstrations early on to get things changed, the Monday night demonstrations, and that different things were going on in the rest of East Germany because it remained so much more depressed, whereas the Soviets had pumped a lot of money into East Berlin as a showplace where Westerners, in fact, would be able to go. And I was wondering if, you know anything about that, or if that was the case, whereas the East Berliners, they were late to joining the rest of the people who were saying take down the wall.
I think that's generally agreed, yeah. I mean, East German provincial cities, Leipzig, Dresden, Halle, and so on, were fine and right in the middle, but you go outside a few streets in the middle and everything was basically falling apart. And East Berlin was heavily subsidized. And I think part of the reason, I mean, Berliners don't like to hear this either, but the fact is a lot of people in East Berlin were privileged people who worked for the government. That's why they were allowed to live in East Berlin. And I think that was part of the reason why it took them a while to come around to it. You know, they wanted to have jobs to go to at the end of it, and they didn't want to get into trouble. I think the Leipzigers and people elsewhere in East Germany didn't have nearly as much to lose.
Hmm. All right. Well, I hope that, again, that gets at the question of the caller. I have one more here, one to get here. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Reinhold Wagenleitner, an Austrian writer, writes a lot about the influence of American culture on Europe in the post-war period. And his thesis is that American popular culture had more to do with undermining the Soviet as well as East German leadership's will to persevere, more so than Reagan's weapons buildup. And he gives an account of a concert with a New Orleans jazzman or bluesman in Berlin in the late 80s when there was already some social unrest. And in those days, party hacks had all of the front row seats, but this was a large concert with 20,000 people. And this unknown American bluesman that we don't even recognize here, between songs, gave this paean to freedom and liberty. And the crowd went wild, and the nomenklatura sat there on their hands. And he says that there actually is evidence that this experience was formative, and the party saying, the only way we can get things back in the can is with heavy repression. It's obvious we have lost the people. And that concert was one of the many formative sort of things that brought down the wall. Have you heard of this concert or this event?
Not specifically, but I know that rock and roll was tremendously influential among East German youth. There were hippies, there were punks. There were a lot of East German punks in the 80s who the regime hated. I mean, obviously, you can't have a communist state in which there's a lot of kids running around saying no future. It was terrifically important. A lot of the people who were expelled, I mean, you know, they were always throwing dissidents out of East Germany, sending them west, so the only people allowed to go west were the rock bands. And it was terrifically important. I mean, the East Germans tried, of course, to import their own American rock star in the shape of Dean Reed. Have you heard of Dean Reed?
No.
He was a guy who'd had a couple of small regional hits in the States, got involved in politics in South America, where he did a tour, and ended up being basically the Eastern Bloc's answer to Elvis Presley. He was also in movies, and was later found dead in mysterious circumstances in East Berlin in the mid-'80s. It's kind of, you know, they're riding a tiger, aren't they, with any kind of popular culture. A state where freedom of expression and of feeling is kind of considered dangerous is not going to like rock and roll or any kind of spontaneous music.
We're going to have to stop. I'm really sorry. There's so much more here that we could talk about that's in this book, including many stories about people who managed to escape from east to west. That is there, and more about how the wall ended up coming down. At least we've talked a little bit about the basic questions of why it went up, why it came down, and why the West reacted the way that they did. And if you'd like to read more about the wall, you'd look for this book that we've been talking about, The Berlin Wall, A World Divided, 1961-1989, published by HarperCollins, by our guest Frederick Taylor. And Mr. Taylor, we want to say to you, thanks very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you are ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.